Part of the blasphemy of mankind is to think that God is just like us, only a little bit bigger. That somehow God is made in man's image. That we have lost the awe, the respect, the fear of God. Yet we need to think of God in all his magnitude if we're to really understand our own selves in our finitude and in our magnitude as well. We need to think about God who is the creator of the world. We ponder for a while what that will involve, how great one will be to be the world's creator. Take a part of it. You can take any part, take the water. You fly over the ocean, you're up there at many thousand feet and you look down and as far as you can see in any direction is ocean. Sydney, for all its mammoth sprawl of suburbs, just a drop in the ocean. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Yet it's too big for us to comprehend. The ocean's enormous. You go down the surf, especially if you go the way I go, you feel the power of the waves pushing you around almost as if you're nothing, almost as if your great bulk is like that of just a little piece of balsa wood that's being bounced around from side to side. You go and look at any one of the drops of water under a microscope and you see it teeming with life, all manner of life, little wiggly things all over the countryside there. And you realise that all those billions and billions of drops of water in that enormous ocean, God has made the lot of it. When we reflect upon God, the maker of the universe, we realise his size. And when we reflect even further, that he is not like us. He is holy and righteous. He is one of truth and integrity in every part. We realise he is not only different from us in his magnitude, but in his very integrity and purity. The nation Israel had it outlined for them regularly and consistently. Every time they went to the temple, they could see God as being different to themselves. The God who dwelt everywhere especially chose to reveal himself at the temple and within the temple, especially in the Holy of Holies. The veiled off little section in the temple in which only one man could go each year and then only once a year. For God in his purity was too pure, too great to allow man to approach him freely and easily. And of course, in that approach in the temple, it required a right high priest, one who had come from the right lineage, one who had been appointed by God to undertake this special work of approaching him on behalf of the people, and who himself had to offer sacrifices for his own sins, who had to go through ritual washings to purify himself before he could take this enormous step of entering into God's very presence. The whole temple was an illustration both of man approaching God and man being unable to approach God at the same time. And the priests were appointed by God from the tribe of Levi. After one of the early Levites, the man Aaron, Moses' brother, he is the great high priest who is first appointed. And so the priesthood of Israel is sometimes called the Aaronic priesthood after Aaron, sometimes the Levitical priesthood, for they come from the tribe of Levi. And when we look at the world and the religions of the world, we see people seeking to put themselves in touch with the other existence, however that may be defined by the various religions. with a something beyond that which you would normally expect to see. Even inside our Christian umbrella, our Judaic Christian umbrella, if you like, that broad circle of people who will in some way align themselves with Christian theism, there are all manner of ways in which people are suggesting that we come right with a God who is a holy God and a true God. Certain forms of observances, or rules, or regulations, or cultic gatherings, or holy buildings, or holy people, who will enable us somehow to come in touch, come into the presence of that God who created the universe and who lives in moral integrity far beyond that which we can really even understand in a world so dominated by sin and in lives so dominated by immorality as ours happen to be. Tonight, when we come to chapter 7 of the Epistle to the Hebrews, we enter upon the real message of the epistle and of the Bible as a whole, I may say. Here we come into the relationship between man and God and how we can approach God. And over the next few chapters of this epistle, we come to the very core of the relationship between God and man and our approach to God. And the answer that this epistle gives is so fundamentally radical that none of the religions of the world, or really the majority of the religions that call themselves Christian, have never understood it. Here we come to something which, when understood, sets apart the faith of the Bible from any alternative. This is a unique element of Christian understanding. Here you will understand why it is that Christians can never be religious. Why it is that Christians have got really no cultic activity. Why it is that Christians have an access to God which is fundamentally different to any alternative suggestion. And if it be true, is the only access to God that is available to mankind. Here we come to really the core of what the whole thing is about, and its implications in our own Christian practice are so far-reaching that I'd suggest they have already divided the Christian church over the centuries, and even tonight can be again divisive, for as I speak of these things, there'll be some who I'm sure will disagree, if not be shocked by them, even in a group which by and large have come through Hebrews 7 before. However, before we can reach that, we need to look at the chapter, and I'm going to take it in three sections, as you can see from the outline. And the first two sections are not easy for us to understand, not because they're difficult passages in themselves, they're fairly straightforward in themselves, but they require a knowledge of the Old Testament and the idea of priests and Levites and Melchizedek, which most people don't have. That is, the author is writing to a group of Christians who have got an understanding of the Old Testament and who have lived in Jewish circles and so understand what priests do and don't do and how they do it. And it's easy for him to refer to these people to these facts. However, you and I don't live in those circles, and so some explanations will be needed. So that points two, Melchizedek, and points three, the imperfection of the Aaronic priesthood, are going to be hard work for us to think about, but once we start getting into the superiority of the new priesthood, you will find the scales falling off the eyes, I hope. And once we see the therefore, you will see that what this passage calls upon us to do and to be is to be radically different from any religious alternative or any Christian alternative, to really come into a relationship with God which is of a fundamentally different order than one we would ever have expected or dreamt up. So it's worth hanging on through the hard sections. A couple of weeks ago, my watch broke, and so I haven't got a watch. Peter, may I borrow yours, please? Because Melchizedek might take me so long that we won't get to the end. Thank you, Jeff. Lent me yours. Well, now, that, by the way, doesn't make a slightest difference as to how long it'll take me. Just makes you feel better, doesn't it? I think I've got a watch there in front of me. Not true. I will take careful attention. Firstly, then, let us look at verses 1 to 10, where it speaks of Melchizedek. The author picks out certain characteristics of this character, Melchizedek. He is only referred to twice in the Old Testament, and we've had both those readings tonight, in Genesis chapter 14 and Psalm 110. And in Genesis 14, amongst all those other names, for which we give Peter great credit for having read them, I noticed one that was incorrect, of course, but in that terrible long list of names that he handled there, Melchizedek comes by and he passes before you've even noticed he's there. He's only mentioned in a couple of verses. And in Psalm 110, it's a great shock that verse 4 is there. In fact, you could drop verse 4 out, and I'm not sure that anyone would really notice it, except the authors of the New Testament. They thought it was very important, and indeed it is, critical. What do we know of Melchizedek? Infuriatingly little. But what we do know is intriguing, says the author. For you'll notice that he blessed Abraham after Abraham had had the great victory, and that he received a tithe from Abraham. That is, he is a priest whom Abraham paid the priest's price to. To whom Abraham paid the priest's price of one-tenth. And his name and title is King of Righteousness. The word Melchizedek comes from two Hebrew words, or forms of two Hebrew words. The Melchi bit is part of the Hebrew word for king. Zedek bit is part of the word for righteousness. He's the King of Righteousness. That's what his name means. And the place where he is the king of is Salem. That is peace. You know that Hebrew word, shalom, don't you? That is the idea of peace. Jerusalem is the city of peace. And so it may be that he's the king of Jerusalem, the city of peace. That's a very elevated and dignified title to be carrying around, isn't it? King of righteousness, king of peace. But what is even more intriguing in this mysterious character is that he has no ancestors. He's got no beginning and no ending. He just suddenly appears. And while ever he's on the stage in chapter 14, he is acting as a priest. He is always the priest. Everything you know about Melchizedek in the Old Testament is he's a priest. Always functioning in that pattern. And in Psalm 110, the psalmist, the Messiah, is promised that he shall become a priest forever. Like Melchizedek, who's always been the priest. A priest forever. And therefore our author here says in verse 3 of Hebrews 7 that he is like the Son of God, in that Melchizedek continues forever. Therefore, he is superior to the Aaronic or Levitical priesthood. Remember, this epistle is written to a group of people who have left Judaism and become Christians. And now, under trial and tribulation and persecution and difficulty, they are considering going back into Judaism. And the author is trying to encourage them to see that that step back into Judaism is a retrograde step. That really is going back. And indeed, it's a denial of what Judaism is all about, as we'll see in the coming chapters especially. Now, you can understand the pressure a Jewish Christian would have been under in the first century. People come to him and say, well, look, what do you think you've got now that you're a Christian? You haven't got the priesthood anymore, have you? You haven't got the Levitical priesthood. How can you be right with God if you haven't got the Levitical priesthood, the people who have been appointed by God to approach God on your behalf? You don't have them anymore. You don't have the sacrifices anymore. How can you be right with God if you don't have the sacrifices every week for your sins? How can you be right if you're not really part of the temple scene? How can you be right with God if you've cut yourself off from the covenant of Israel? I mean, you're missing out on all the big things. Our author is to say, what we have is greater than the Levitical priesthood. We have the priesthood of Melchizedek, who is greater than the priesthood of Levi, because Abraham gave a tenth to Melchizedek. That is, Melchizedek was Abraham's priest. And Levi was Abraham's, great-grandson. grandson, great-grandson. Great-grandson, that's right. Great-grandson.
Sorry about that.
Right, generation's confused. So you see, when Abraham is giving that tenth to Melchizedek, Levi, his great-grandson, is down inside him, isn't he? Right? He hasn't been thought of yet, you may say. But Levi is part of Abraham's body, and so Levi also is giving over a tenth. So you want to know who Levi's priest is? Levi's priest is Melchizedek. Because he's paid off as a priest of Abraham. Abraham didn't have Levi as his priest. And remember, the one who does the blessing is always superior to the one who is blessed. And Melchizedek blessed Abraham, so Melchizedek is greater than Abraham. And Abraham's the father of the Jewish nation. So you want to say, look, you've been cut off from the Jewish nation. So yes, I've been cut off from them and put in the hand of the person who is greater than the Jewish nation, for he was greater than the patriarch, Abraham. He who blesses is superior to the one who is blessed. And more than that, verse 8 points to the fact that Melchizedek lives on forever. Oh, the priesthood. There's a long list of high priests. There's some 83 high priests between Aaron and the time of Jesus, all of whom had dropped off. They'd all died, you see. One after another, you can have a great long honour roll of priests, but the one thing in common is they're all dead. That's their real common trick now. I mean, there's a couple of other things. They're all in the tribe of Levi, and they all served as high priests. But the thing that really gets you is that you don't get on the honour roll until you've kicked it. And so they're all dead. But this Melchizedek, he doesn't die. Got no beginning, no end. This high priesthood we're involved in is an eternal high priesthood, always there, ready. So his first argument deals with Melchizedek. But his second takes it a stage further. He says that the Aaronic priesthood, the Levitical priesthood, is actually one which is imperfect, because it's one that has to be changed. And change implies imperfection. Now, if perfection had been attainable, verse 11, through the Levitical priesthood, what further need would there have been for another priest to arise after the order of Melchizedek, rather than the one named after the order of Aaron? You don't change something that's right and working and proper. You know that from the selection of cricket teams and football teams, don't you? If they're winning, you leave them alone. If they're losing, in the Australia, you still seem to leave them alone. Can't quite work that out. However, a right and proper and working one, you certainly leave alone. Now, if the high priesthood is working well, there's no need for a change, but yet. Psalm 110 promises a new priesthood that is coming, one after the order of Melchizedek. And the old method, we're told in verse 18, was weak and helpless because it never brought people perfection, but rather its very continued performance showed people that it had failed. It's like makeup. If by putting makeup on you, for once you were fully, perfectly beautiful, you'd not need to put it on again tomorrow, would you? The very fact that you've got to keep on putting it on day after day after day is the clear indication that it was never effective in the first place. Now, the continued application, I've never tried that one before, and I have to think out all the ramifications. But the continued application of the priesthood, having to offer sacrifices day after day after day, showed that the people had never really been cleansed in the first place. It was weak and helpless. The temple was a symbol of people approaching God, but it was so bound up in rules and regulations, it was so guarded off and fenced off from the people, that it was also a symbol of the fact that the people could never approach God. And it taught that as clearly as it taught that you can approach God. It was a weak and helpless system, for the law made nothing perfect. So, the law needs to be changed as well. The priesthood is written in the law. It's written in the law that only the tribe of Levi should be priests. But our Lord Jesus comes from the tribe of Judah. And he has been appointed as the great high priest. The priesthood after Melchizedek. Not by law, nor by bodily descent, but by his resurrection.
You see the subject about changing the law in verses 13 and 14. For the one whom these things are spoken belonged to another tribe from which no one has ever served the altar. For it is evident that our Lord was descended from Judah. And in connection with that tribe, Moses said nothing about priests. This becomes even more evident when another priest arises in the likeness of Melchizedek, who has become a priest not according to legal requirement. That's not how he comes. Nor concerning bodily descent. That's not the way. But by the power of an indestructible life. For what is the characteristic of a Melchizedek priest? He lives forever. And what is the characteristic of Jesus that so strikes you? Is that having died, he rises again. He is one who is indestructible like Melchizedek. He lives forever. And it is in his exaltation that you see the priest after the order of Melchizedek. And that point has been made earlier in chapter 5, verses 6 and 10, where again you see the appointment of Jesus as high priest comes in his exaltation through his resurrection, that he is truly the one who fulfilled Psalm 110, verse 4, "Thou art priest forever, after the order of Melchizedek, the one to whom the Lord said, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies a stool for your feet." So the law has had to change. For this one has been appointed high priest by his resurrection and by the promise of Psalm 110. And that you see in verse 17, "For it was witnessed of him, thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." And so this new priest is appointed by resurrection. Jesus' indestructibility shows how he fulfilled the Melchizedek promise. For two things flow from that. Firstly, the commandments have been set aside. And secondly, a new hope has been opened up for us. The old, weak, useless religion has been done away with. Take note of that point. Those of you who are finding it a great struggle to wander through this Melchizedek section, let me ring a little bell for you now that we'll be back to. That the old has now been set aside by this act of Jesus. That is not the way in which he gives you an approach to God. He's actually removed that way as the way in which people approach God. The old priesthood, the old law, is actually set aside by Jesus in becoming the priest after the order of Melchizedek. And more, a new hope is introduced. Here is a better expectation that has arrived. The possibility of really drawing near to God. Permanently drawing near to God. We who are small and sinful, drawing near to the Almighty and the righteous. Verse 19, "For the law made nothing perfect." On the other hand, a better hope is introduced through which we draw near to God. So, here comes the reward for those who can follow the argument. More than that, here we start to enter into the very heart of what the gospel is about, our relationship with God. Here we come to how we can come into a relationship with God. How it is that I can actually approach the Almighty Maker of the universe and call him Father. I cannot approach the great ones of this world like that. I have to bow and scrape. I have to put on my best suits and be apologetic. And I have to do all kinds of nice things to be allowed to go into their living rooms. And then I can only come by invitation. And then I've been waiting all my life so far, and the invitation to Buckingham Palace is yet to arrive. They're very few and far between. Why, I heard of a man the other day who had spent his last 10 years of his life looking forward to the telegram from the Queen, and he died 6 months short of 100. I mean, he got even that far and he didn't get the invite. In fact, even if you do reach 100, you don't get an invite, you just get a cheerio call, which I presume some public servant does anyway. And I don't mean the Queen when I call the public servant. The great ones of this world are not easily approached. But the great ones of this world are nothing
compared to the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, the rulers of rulers, the creator of empires and universes, the destroyer of empires and universes. And yet I can go into his presence and call him Father, call him Dad. And of course the kings of this world, they are as immoral as I am. They're more notoriously immoral than I am because they've had more opportunities than I have. But they are basically the same as I am, immoral through and through. And so I need to go into them cringing in fear lest they immorally should judge me, even if I be innocent. I never approach them with confidence and happiness. I'm always afraid of them for the power they wield and the immorality with which they wield it. And so their immorality terrifies me, even though their immorality shows that they are just like I am. They're no different to me. Got the same problems that I have. But the God with whom I'm dealing is even more terrifying than they because he is thoroughly moral, thoroughly pure. I've never had to deal with anyone like that before. I deal with you, I don't have to deal with someone like that, do I? You're a liar like I'm a liar. You have done things that you're ashamed of like I've done things that I'm ashamed of. I know that, you know that, we can know that about each other. I'm not afraid of you and your moral integrity. Nothing to be afraid of in that regard, just like you're not afraid of me and my moral integrity, because you've got nothing to be afraid about in that regard. If I should tick you off about some blemish in your face, you can equally tick me off about some in mine, can't you? We are very much equals like that. But now I'm approaching somebody who has never done anything that is wrong, and who sees right through me. Well, it is that many people would rather not approach him. Rather not to be face to face with someone who knows all that we do and would never do such things, who finds the way in which we conduct ourselves as abhorrent as we find ourselves sometimes when we allow ourselves to look. See, I don't allow myself to look very often. I mean, I'd be in a psychiatric ward most of my days if I did, wouldn't I? If I really did look back over all those things that I've thought and that I've done, it would give me severe problems, wouldn't it? There is a way around that, which I'll explain later. But by and large, that statement is true. And so what we do is we cover up ourselves. We pretend to ourselves that we are not like what we are. And we try our darndest to pretend it to other people too, don't we? We never let them into the secret that we are like we are, what we are. I mean, we don't tell lies, do we? We're truthful people. Greatest lie of all time, that one. Constant sham is going on between me and other people because there's a sham going on between me and myself because I cannot face up to it. And of course, there is that terrible attempt at sham between me and God that I don't want him looking in too much either. And I cannot face up to that because there is no way I can cover up from him. He was there when I did it, and he saw. He knows. There is no way I can cover that up from him. And so here we talk, in this chapter, about how we come into the presence of that God. And it's through this great high priest. Look at his superiority over the other priests in verses 20 to 28. Three ways you see his superiority. Firstly, he is the one who is appointed with an oath. The old priesthood didn't receive an oath from God, but in Psalm 110, we see that God swears an oath. Such a solemn thing is taking place. But he swears, "Thou art a priest forever." God will not change his mind on this matter. He has established this priesthood with such solemnity. And therefore, we have a new covenant, a new agreement with God. The word testament, from which we get our Old and New Testament, is the word for covenant, is the word agreement, legal contract, if you like. This legal contract is struck, a new legal contract. Next week, when we look at Hebrews chapter 8, we will see the character of this new legal contract, because that's the theme of chapter 8. Chapter 7 is about the priest, chapter 8 is about the covenant, the new legal contract. But notice what's said here. Jesus is the surety of this covenant.
That's an unusual word. I think it's the only occasion it's used in the New Testament. It's not just that he's a mediator, a go-between. He's a surety. Let me think of a legal contract that we might have here. You see, we have Steve Marquette down the front row here, and we have Don over here in the other corner, and they could be having a legal contract between each other, but of course they don't get on with each other too well. That's why one's sitting over there and the other sitting over here. Because they don't get on too well, they call upon me to act as a mediator for them. And so I explain the terms to Don, and then I get Don's terms back, and I explain them to Steve, and I do a bit of shuttle diplomacy here, and in the end, I get them signed up on the dotted line. The contract's got nothing to do with me, has it? It's between those two people. I'm just acting as the go-between. But this word surety is a much stronger word. It's a different word. Different concept is here involved. I get from Steve promises. I get from Don promises. And I say to him, all right, let's sign up on this. And if Steve reneges, I'll fulfill the promises for him. And if Don reneges, I'll fulfill the promises for him. I'm acting as the surety for you both. You don't act as a surety for many people, do you? Certainly not that's do. I won't be doing that soon, right? You don't act for surety for people because you're actually underwriting what is involved. Jesus is the surety to mankind of God's favour. And Jesus is the surety of mankind to God of sins fully paid for. It's a very striking figure, this word surety. He really does go as the go-between between man and God. Not just as a shuttle diplomat, but as one who truly represents God to man, truly represents man to God. The second way in which you see he is a superior high priest is that he is the only one in this order. Priests come and go, they died off regularly. Some were better, some were worse, most were worse. All of them were learners, like doctors, they were practitioners the whole time. Never actually arrive, do they? They've always got to be in practice. That should worry you, shouldn't it? Well, high priests were like that, always in practice. Never actually arrived at the scene where you could say, I no longer practice, I'm completed. And you couldn't do that because you could see they were all unsatisfactory. One short test showed they were all unsatisfactory. They were all dead. They all had to pay the penalty for their own sins in the end. They all died. They were all caught up in that sin. And so, the high priests, in their impermanence, were a nuisance to the people of Israel. But Jesus is not like that. He's a permanent one. He is always there, always ready to save who? Whom will he save? Those who draw near to God through him. Beautiful verse there in verse 25, isn't it? Well worth underlining, marking, learning, reading, inwardly digesting. Consequently, he is able for all time to save those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercessions for them. Not living there pleading a hopeless case before a hardened judge, but a victorious case to his loving Father, saying, yes, I stand for this one, and for this one, and for this one, knowing that God will accept them because he stands for them, that people can now draw near to God through him. Note again, folks, that is getting a very crucial issue here, that the way in which a person comes to God is through Jesus, and he is always there. See how that cuts through religion. What do I have to do? Nothing. Which church do I have to go to? No church. What religious activities do I have to get engaged in? No religious activities. How moral do I have to be to do this? No morality required. How do I get to God? Through Jesus. That is the way that is being suggested. That God deals with us on the basis of his relationship with Jesus. For he is the high priest who represents us to God, who takes our case with him to God. He is the one through whom we can approach God. And he is superior in a third way in the verses 26 through to 28. in that he suits our needs perfectly. For he is like us in that he lived amongst us, but unlike us in that he is holy and separated. His life was pure and spotless and different to ours. Utterly different in that regard. And therefore was acceptable to God. He did not have to offer for himself, for he had no sins for which to offer. But when he offered his sacrifice, he was doing it for us. And here is, of course, a great twist. For the sacrifice that he offered is himself. He is both the priest and the sacrifice at the same time. He offers himself, and notice what it says there, once for all time, that sacrifice is offered. And it is the Son, therefore, by whom we are represented. For it is the Son whom has been appointed the high priest, the sacrifice that is offered for us once and for all. And therefore we have the way to the Father. In John chapter 14 and verse 6, Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me." He is the way to the Father. He himself is the perfect way to the Father. For all time, all people who draw near to him, he takes them to the Father. That is what he does for us, because he has paid for the penalty of my sin and of your sin, that we might be able to stand before the Almighty and Perfect One, pure and spotless, sinners though we be. Do you notice what a dramatic change that will make to my own attitude to myself? I foreshadowed that some time ago when I was talking about my ability to look at my own sin. I can look at my sin now. I can feel sorrow for it, but I can laugh at myself about it too. Don't have to hide it from myself anymore, because it's been thoroughly washed. Don't have to pretend it doesn't exist. It exists, and it's been dealt with by my high priest who paid for it. I'm terribly sorry that I should have brought such suffering upon him, but I'm not so afraid of it that I can't face up to it. I'm not so afraid of it that I have to pretend it's not there. And I don't have to pretend to myself. And joy over joy, I don't have to pretend to you either. I can tell you what I am without any pretense about it, because it's been dealt with. It's over. It's done. The penalty's been paid. It's been washed away. It's clean. It's old scars. They're there. They'll be there with me for years. But they're really of no value or importance or significance anymore. Because I no longer have to pretend to God, I don't have to pretend to myself, I don't have to pretend to you. And all who are Christians are in that state, where there is no need for pretense, no need for cover-up, because we've brought them out into the open to be dealt with, and to be dealt with properly by the high priest who has paid for them fully himself by dying in our place. He is the way for me to come into a relationship with God. And the other part of John 14:6 is that no man comes to the Father but by me. For when Jesus becomes the great high priest after the order of Melchizedek, bringing people into that relationship with God, he sets aside all alternative ways, none of which were ever effective anyway. And here is a lesson that so few people have ever seemed to grasp, because they continually want to turn back to other forms of religious experience in order to get near to God. The people to whom this epistle was written were people who wanted to go back into the Levitical priesthood, into the sacrifices, into the whole scene of Judaism as the way to God, not realizing that when you had Jesus Christ, you've got something better than was ever available to you under that system. And today, throughout the history of the Christian church, people have restored the Levitical priesthood, have established priests and temples and sacrifices, have continued to repeat the sacrifice of Jesus as if somehow they can approach God with that. So I am called by some a priest. Indeed, in the Church of England, I am a priest. I have been ordained as a priest. The 16th century use of the word was different to the 20th century use of the word. That's why I don't use it very often of myself. But there are those who will think of me as a priest, as some kind of go-between between them and God. Hey, Lord, I can't go between you and God. There's no way in the world I can account for my own sins. How can I be handling yours? There's no way for me to be handling you. I cannot do that. And anyway, why would you need me? I'm a second-rate one, even if I was one. If you've got Jesus, what on earth would you need me for? Jesus is far more significant than any priest that might care to pop up around the scene. That is not the way. Nor is the thing up that end of the building where God is supposed to dwell, for it is called by some a sanctuary, but goodness knows why, it's only just a bit of the building that we can't use very easily. Nor is that thing up there called an altar. Some people will call it an altar, as if we perform a sacrifice up there. But somehow that sacrifice up there and being involved in that sacrifice will draw you near to God. There's no sacrifice that you can offer that can draw you nearer to God than the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. If you have got Jesus Christ, you can't get closer to God. How can you get closer than being right with the one who sits next to God? If you are in Jesus Christ, you are as close to God as it is possible to get. And there's no reason that you can think that by coming into this building, you somehow get closer to God. You don't get closer to God at all. You move marginally away from the traffic noise of Oxford Street. On a fine day, you move into a place where you won't get wet from the rain. But there's very little other than going to offer you that. Well, it leaks. That's why I've got to use that illustration. It's only useful in this, in fine weather even. It's not even a particularly good rain shelter. You don't really move closer to God by being here. You move closer to God by being in Jesus. That is the way you get closer to God. That is the only way you get closer to God. And if you're that close to God, well, you can't get closer anyway by any other thing you care to do. They are the traditional aberrations of the Christian message, which you will find in almost every denomination and in every church around the land. For it is a continued way of people as they preen themselves in religiosity, as they mark their buildings as being the house of God, rather than the people as being the house of God, for that is where God's Spirit dwells. Where they mark their ministers out not as servants, but as go-betweens between man and God, and wrap them up in holy robes and put them in holy buildings, in holy ends of holy buildings. That is all that whole procedure. And I don't care which denomination you care to go to, you will find they all do it. They cannot bear seeing a building unless it's got stained glass windows and crosses in it somewhere. It's got to have that. It's not holy if it hasn't got that. Always will have that. You worship God not in the beauty of holiness, but in the holy of beautiness, whatever that may be. As if somehow, if it's a plain building, it's not really worshipping God. Terrible blasphemies of the gospel. Misses the whole point. If you're in Christ Jesus, you cannot get closer to God. For Jesus is the way to God. And all other ways are useless and have been set aside. But more than that, people now want to have, and this is not in the Epistle of Hebrews, I actually move out a further step to illustrate how it will go. People will want to get closer to God by some kind of mystic experience over and above Jesus Christ, by some kind of guru that they might set up who will show them some transcendental form of meditating whereby they will get closer to God, some kind of supersensory experience that will somehow lift them out of themselves and move into out-of-body kind of experiences, and therefore think that they've gone into the spiritual realm. Well, they may have got into the spiritual realm, because that's where Satan dwells too, I would remind you. Maybe in the spiritual realm, but you'll never be closer to God than in Jesus Christ. And so if you've got him, you don't need anything else. For when you study Hebrews 7 and see the great high priest, and what is said of him, as we have seen what has been said of him in chapters 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, because this epistle is all about Jesus, isn't it? When you consider Jesus, as chapter 3, 1 encourages you to do, when you consider Jesus, you know that you do not need anything else, provided you have Jesus. For if you have not drawn near to God through him, then you're as far away as your sins. And that is as far away as you can get. So draw near to God through Jesus.